sand to her tongue. All of the background was there, the dune of other memory and the racket of this day. Shiana pointed at an angle to her left, directly into the light breeze from the desert. "Out there! We must hurry!" Without waiting for permission from O'Drade, Shiana ran lightly down the causeway past Waf and out onto the first dune. She stopped there until O'Drade and Waf caught up with her. Off the dune face she led them, up another with sand clogging their passage, out along a great curving barrican, with wisps of dusty saltation blowing from its crest. Soon they had put almost a kilometre between themselves and the water-girded security of Dar es Balat. Again Shiana stopped. Waf came to a panting halt behind her. Perspiration glistened where his still-suit hood crossed his brow. O'Drade stopped a pace behind Waf. She took deep, calming breaths while she peered past Waf to where Shiana's attention was fixed. A furious tide of sand had poured across the desert beyond the dune where they stood, driven by a storm wind. Bedrock lay exposed in a long, narrow avenue of giant boulders, which lay scattered and upturned like the broken building blocks of a mad Promethean. Through this wild maze, the sand had poured like a river, leaving its signature in deep scratches and gouges, then plunging off a low escarpment to lose itself in more dunes. "Down there," Shiana said, pointing at the avenue of bedrock. Off their dune she went, sliding and scrambling in spilled sand. At the bottom she stopped beside a boulder at least twice her height. Waf and O'Drade paused just behind her. The slip face of another giant barrican, sinuous as the back of a sporting whale, lifted into the silver-blue sky beside them. O'Drade used the pause to recompose her oxygen balance. That mad run had made great demands on flesh. Waf, she noted, was red-faced and breathing deeply. The flinty cinnamon smell was oppressive in the confined passage. Waf sniffed and rubbed at his nose with the back of a hand. Shiana lifted herself on one toe, pivoted and darted 10 paces across the rocky avenue. She put one foot up on the sandy incline of the outer dune and lifted both arms to the sky. Slowly at first, and then with increasing tempo, she began to dance, moving up onto the sand. The thopter sounds grew louder overhead. "Listen," Shiana called, not pausing in her dance. It was not to the thopters that she called their attention. O'Drade turned her head to present both ears to a new sound intruding on their rock-tumbled maze. A sibilant hiss, subterranean and muted by sand, it became louder with shocking swiftness. There was heat in it, a noticeable warming of the breeze that twisted down their rocky avenue. The hissing swelled to a crescendo roar. Abruptly, the crystal-ringed gaping of a gigantic mouth lifted over the dune directly above Shiana. "Shaitan!" Shiana screamed, not breaking the rhythm of her dance. "Here I am, Shaitan!" As it crested the dune, the worm dipped its mouth downward toward Shiana. Sand cascaded around her feet, forcing her to stop her dance. The smell of cinnamon filled the rocky defile. The worm stopped above them.
"Messenger of God,"
Waf breathed. Heat dried the perspiration on O'Drade's exposed face and made the automatic insulation of her stillsuit puff outward perceptibly. She inhaled deeply, sorting the components behind that cinnamon assault. The air around them was sharp with ozone and swiftly oxygen-rich. Her senses at full alert, O'Drade stored impressions. "If I survive," she thought. Yes, this was valuable data. The day might come when others would use it. Shiana backed out of the spilled sand onto the exposed rock. She resumed her dance, moving more wildly, flinging her head at each turn. Hair whipped across her face, and each time she whirled to confront the worm, she screamed, "Shaitan!" Daintily, like a child on unfamiliar ground, the worm once more moved forward. It slid across the dune crest, curled itself down onto the exposed rock, and presented its burning mouth slightly above and about 2 paces from Shiana. As it stopped, O'Drade became conscious of the deep furnace rumbling of the worm. She could not tear her gaze away from the reflections of lambent orange flames within the creature. It was a cave of mysterious fire. Shiana stopped her dance. She clenched both fists at her sides and stared back at the monster she had summoned. O'Drade took timed breaths, the controlled pacing of a reverend mother gathering all of her powers. If this was the end, well, she had obeyed Taraza's orders. Let the Mother Superior learn what she would from the watchers overhead.
"Hallo, Shaitan," Shiana said. "I have brought a reverend mother and a man of the Tlelaxu with me."
Waf slumped to his knees and bowed. Odraid slipped past him to stand beside Shiana. Shiana breathed deeply. Her face was flushed. Odraid heard the click-ticking of their overworked stillsuits. The hot, cinnamon-drenched air around them was charged with the sounds of this meeting, all dominated by the murmurous burning within the quiescent worm. Waf came up beside Odraid, his trance-like gaze fixed on the worm.
"I am here," he whispered.
Odraid silently cursed him. Any unwarranted noise could attract this beast onto them. She knew what Waf was thinking, though. No other Tlelaxu had ever stood this close to a descendant of his prophet. Not even the Rakian priests had ever done this. With her right hand, Shiana made a sudden downward gesture.
"Down to us, Shaitan," she said.
The worm lowered its gaping mouth until the internal fire pit filled the rocky defile in front of them. Her voice little more than a whisper, Shiana said,
"See how Shaitan obeys me, mother."
Odraid could feel Shiana's control over the worm, a pulse of hidden language between child and monster. It was uncanny. Her voice rising in impudent arrogance, Shiana said,
"I will ask Shaitan to let us ride him."
She scrambled up the slip face of the dune beside the worm. Immediately the great mouth lifted to follow her movements.
"Stay there,"
Shiana shouted. The worm stopped.
It's not her words that command it, Odraid thought. Something else. Something else.
"Mother, come with me,"
Shiana called. Thrusting Waf ahead of her, Odraid obeyed. They scrambled up the sandy slope behind Shiana. Dislodged sand spilled down beside the waiting worm, piling up in the defile. Ahead of them, the worm's tapering tail curved along the dune crest. Shiana led them at a sand-clotted trot to the very tip of the thing. There, she gripped the leading edge of a ring in the corrugated surface and scrambled up onto her desert beast. More slowly, Odraid and Waf followed. The worm's warm surface felt non-organic to Odraid, as though it were some Ixian artifact. Shiana skipped forward along the back and squatted just behind its mouth, where the rings bulged thick and wide.
"Like this," Shiana said.
She leaned forward and clutched beneath the leading edge of a ring, lifting it slightly to expose pink softness underneath. Waf obeyed her immediately, but Odraid moved with more caution, storing impressions. The ring surface was as hard as plascrete and covered with tiny encrustations. Odraid's fingers probed the softness under the leading edge. It pulsed faintly. The surface around them lifted and fell with an almost imperceptible rhythm. Odraid heard a tiny rasping with each movement. Shiana kicked the worm surface behind her.
"Shaitan, go,"
she said. The worm did not respond.
"Please, Shaitan,"
Shiana pleaded. Odraid heard the desperation in Shiana's voice. The child was so confident of her Shaitan, but Odraid knew that the girl had been allowed to ride only that first time. Odraid had the full story, from death wish to priestly confusion, but none of it told her what would happen next. Abruptly, the worm lurched into motion. It lifted sharply, twisted to the left, and made a tight curve out of the rocky defile, then moved directly away from Dar es Balat into the open desert.
"We go with God,"
Waf shouted. The sound of his voice shocked Odraid. Such wildness. She sensed the power in his faith. The thwock-thwock of following ornithopters came from overhead. The wind of their passage whipped past Odraid, full of ozone and the hot furnace odors stirred up by the friction of the rushing behemoth. Odraid glanced over her shoulders at the thopters, thinking how easy it would be for enemies to rid this planet of a troublesome child, an equally troublesome reverend mother, and a despised Tlelaxu, all in one violently vulnerable moment on the open desert. The priestly cabal might attempt it, she knew, hoping that Odraid's own watchers up there would be too late to prevent it. Would curiosity and fear hold them back? Odraid admitted to a mighty curiosity herself.
Where is this thing taking us?
Certainly it was not headed toward Keen. She lifted her head and peered past Shiana. On the horizon directly ahead lay that telltale indentation of fallen stones, that place where the tyrant had been spilled from the surface of his fairy bridge. The place of other memory, warning. Abrupt revelation locked Odraid's mind. She understood the warning. The tyrant had died at a place of his own choosing. Many deaths had left their imprint on that place, but his the greatest. The tyrant chose his peregrination route with purpose. Shiana had not told her worm to go there. It moved that way of its own volition. The magnet of the tyrant's endless dream drew it back to the place where the dream began. There was this drylander who asked which was more important, a litajon of water or a vast pool of water. The drylander thought a moment and then said, "The litajon is more important. No single person could own a great pool of water. But a litajon you could hide under your cloak and run away with it. No one would know." The Jokes of Ancient Dune, Bene Gesserit Archives. It was a long session in the No Globes practice hall, Duncan in a mobile cage driving the exercise, adamant that this particular training series would continue until his new body had adapted to the 7 central attitudes of combat response against attack from 8 directions. His green single suit was dark with perspiration. 20 days they had been at this one lesson. Teg knew the ancient lore that Duncan revived here, but knew it by different names and sequencing. Before they had been into it 5 days, Teg doubted the superiority of modern methods. Now he was convinced that Duncan did something completely new, mixing the old with what he had learned in the keep. Teg sat at his own control console, as much an observer as a participant. The consoles that guided the dangerous shadow forces in this practice had required mental adjustment by Teg, but he felt familiar with them now and moved the attack with facility and frequent inspiration. A simmering Lucilla glanced into the hall occasionally. She watched and then left without comment. Teg did not know what Duncan was doing about the imprinter, but there was a feeling that the reawakened Gola played a delaying game with his seductress. She would not allow that to continue long, Teg knew, but it was out of his hands. Duncan no longer was too young for the imprinter. That young body carried a mature male mind with experiences from which to make his own decisions. Duncan and Teg had been on the floor with only one break all morning. Hunger pangs gnawed at Teg, but he felt reluctant to halt the session. Duncan's abilities had climbed to a new level today, and he was still improving. Teg, seated in a fixed console's cage seat, twisted the attack forces into a complex maneuver, striking from left, right, and above. The Harkonnen Armory had produced an abundance of these exotic weapons and training instruments, some of which Teg had known only from historical accounts. Duncan knew them all, apparently, and with an intimacy that Teg admired. Hunter seekers geared to penetrate a force shield were part of the shadow system they used now.
"They automatically slow down to go through the shield," Duncan explained in his young old voice. "Too fast a strike, of course, and the shield repels."
"Shields of that type have almost gone out of fashion," Teg said. "A few societies maintain them as a kind of sport, but otherwise..."
Duncan executed a riposte of blurred speed that dropped 3 hunter seekers to the floor, damaged enough to require the No Globe's maintenance services. He removed the cage and dampened the system, but left it idling while he came over to Teg, breathing deeply but easily. Looking past Teg, Duncan smiled and nodded. Teg whirled, but there was only the flick of Lucilla's gown as she left them.
"It's like a duel," Duncan said. "She tries to thrust through my guard, and I counterattack."
"Have a care," Teg said. "That's a full reverend mother."
"I've known a few of them in my time, Basher."
Once more, Teg found himself confounded. He had been warned that he would have to readjust to this different Duncan Idaho, but he had not fully anticipated the constant mental demands of that readjustment. The look in Duncan's eyes right now was disconcerting.
"Our roles have changed a bit, Basher," Duncan said.
He picked up a towel from the floor and mopped his face.
"I'm no longer sure of what I can teach you," Teg admitted.
He wished, though, that Duncan would take his warning about Lucilla. Did Duncan imagine that the Reverend Mothers of those ancient days were identical with the women of today? Teg thought that highly unlikely. In the way of all other life, the Sisterhood evolved and changed. It was obvious to Teg that Duncan had come to a decision about his place in Taraz's machinations. Duncan was not merely biding his time. He was training his body to a personally chosen peak, and he had made a judgment about the Bene Gesserit.
He has made that judgment on insufficient data, Teg thought.
Duncan dropped the towel and looked at it for a moment.
Let me be the judge of what you can teach me, Basha.
He turned and stared narrowly at Teg seated in the cage. Teg inhaled deeply. He smelled the faint ozone from all of this durable Harkonnen equipment ticking away in readiness for Duncan's return to action. The Gula's perspiration carried a bitter dominant. Duncan sneezed. Teg sniffed, recognizing the omnipresent dust of their activities. It could be more tasted than smelled at times. Alkaline. Over it all was the fragrance of the air scrubbers and oxy-regenerators. There was a distinct floral aroma built into the system, but Teg could not identify the flower. In the month of their occupation, the globe also had taken on human odors, slowly insinuated into the original composite. Perspiration, cooking smells, the never quite suppressed acridity of waste reclamation. To Teg, these reminders of their presence were oddly offensive, and he found himself sniffing and listening for sounds of intrusion, something more than the echoing passage of their own footsteps and the subdued metallic clashings from the kitchen area. Duncan's voice intruded.
You're an odd man, Basha. What do you mean? There's your resemblance to the Duke Leto. The facial identity is weird. He was a bit shorter than you, but the identity...
He shook his head, thinking of the Bene Gesserit designs, behind those genetic markers in Teg's face, that hawk look, the crease lines, and that inner thing, that certainty of moral superiority. How moral, and how superior. According to the records he had seen at the keep, and Duncan was sure they had been placed there especially for him to discover, Teg's reputation was an almost universal thing throughout human society of this age. At the Battle of Marcon, it had been enough for the enemy to know that Teg was there opposite them in person. They sued for terms. Was that true? Duncan looked at Teg in the console cage and put this question to him.
Reputation can be a beautiful weapon, Teg said. It often spills less blood.
At Arbalo, why did you go to the front with your troops? Duncan asked.
Teg showed surprise.
Where did you learn that?
At the keep. You might have been killed. What would that have served?
Teg reminded himself that this young flesh standing over him held unknown knowledge which must guide Duncan's quest for information. It was in that unknown area, Teg suspected, that Duncan was most valuable to the Sisterhood.
We took severe losses at Arbalo on the preceding 2 days, Teg said. I failed to make a correct assessment of the enemy's fear and fanaticism.
But the risk of...
My presence at the front said to my own people, I share your risks.
The keep's record said Arbalo had been perverted by face dancers. Partrin told me you vetoed your aides when they urged you to sweep the planet clean, sterilize it, and...
You were not there, Duncan.
I'm trying to be. So you spared your enemy against all advice?
Except for the face dancers.
But then you walked unarmed through the enemy ranks and before they had laid down their weapons.
To assure them they would not be mistreated.
That was very dangerous.
Was it? Many of them came over to us for the final assault on Croynin, where we broke the anti-Sisterhood forces.
Duncan stared hard at Teg. Not only did this old Basha resemble Duke Leto in appearance, but he also had that same Atreides charisma, a legendary figure even among his former enemies. Teg had said he was descended from Ganima of the Atreides. But there had to be more in it than that. The ways of the Bene Gesserit breeding mastery awed him.
We will go back to the practice now, Duncan said.
Don't damage yourself.
You forget, Basha. I remember a body as young as this one and right here on Gedi Prime.
Gamu.
It was properly renamed, but my body still recalls the original. That is why they sent me here. I know it.
Of course he would know it, Teg thought.
Restored by the brief respite, Teg introduced a new element in the attack and sent a sudden burn line against Duncan's left side.
How easily Duncan parried the attack.
He was using an oddly mixed variation on the five attitudes, each response seemingly invented before it was required.
"Each attack is a feather floating on the infinite road," Duncan said.
His voice gave no hint of exertion.
"As the feather approaches, it is diverted and removed."
As he spoke, he parried the shifting attack and countered. Tegg's Mentat logic followed the movements into what he recognized as dangerous places.
"Dependencies and key logs."
Duncan shifted over to attack, moving ahead of it, pacing his movements rather than responding. Tegg was forced to his utmost abilities as the shadow forces burned and flickered across the floor. Duncan's weaving figure in its mobile cage danced along the space between them. Not one of Tegg's hunter seekers or burn line counters touched the moving figure. Duncan was over them, under them, seeming totally unafraid of the real pain that this equipment could bring him. Once more, Duncan increased the speed of his attack. A bolt of pain shot up Tegg's left arm from his hand on the controls to his shoulder. With a sharp exclamation, Duncan shut down the equipment.
"Sorry, Basha. That was superb defense on your part, but I'm afraid age defeated you."
Once more, Duncan crossed the floor and stood over Tegg.
"A little pain to remind me of the pain I caused you," Tegg said.
He rubbed his tingling arm.
"Blame the heat of the moment," Duncan said. "We've done enough for now."
"Not quite," Tegg said. "It is not enough to strengthen only your muscles."
At Tegg's words, Duncan felt an alerting sensation throughout his body. He sensed the disorganized touch of that uncompleted thing that the reawakening had failed to arouse. Something crouched within him, Duncan thought. It was like a coiled spring waiting for release.
"What more would you do?"
Duncan asked. His voice sounded hoarse.
"Your survival is in the balance here," Tegg said. "All of this is being done to save you and get you to Rakkus."
"For Bene Gesserit reasons, which you say you do not know."
"I don't know them, Duncan."
"But you're a Mentat."
"Mentats require data to make projections."
"Do you think Lucilla knows?"
"I'm not sure, but let me warn you again about her. She has orders to get you to Rakkus prepared for what you must do there."
"Must?"
Duncan shook his head from side to side.
"Am I not my own person, with rights to make my own choices? What do you think you've reawakened here, a damned face dancer capable only of obeying orders?"
"Are you telling me you will not go to Rakkus?"
"I'm telling you I will make my own decisions when I know what it is I'm to do. I'm not a hired assassin."
"You think I am, Duncan?"
"I think you're an honourable man, someone to be admired. Give me credit for having my own standards of duty and honour."
"You've been given another chance at life, and—"
"But you are not my father, and Lucilla is not my mother. Imprinter? For what does she hope to prepare me?"
"It may be that she does not know, Duncan. Like me, she may have only part of the design. Knowing how the Sisterhood works, that is highly likely."
"So, the two of you just train me and deliver me to Arrakis. Here's the package you ordered."
"This is a far different universe than the one where you were originally born," Tegg said. "As it was in your day, we still have a great convention against atomics and the pseudo-atomics of lasergun shield interaction. We still say that sneak attacks are forbidden. There are pieces of paper scattered around to which we have put our names, and we—"
"But no ships have changed the basis for all of those treaties," Duncan said. "I think I learned my history fairly well at the Keep. Tell me, Basha, why did Paul's son have the Tleilaxu provide him with my Gola self, hundreds of me, for all those thousands of years?"
"Paul's son?"
"The Keep's records call him the God Emperor. You name him Tyrant."
"Oh, I don't think we know why he did it. Perhaps he was lonely for someone from—"
"You brought me back to confront the worm," Duncan said.
"Is that what we're doing?"
Tegg wondered. He had considered this possibility more than once, but it was only a possibility, not a projection. Even so, there had to be something more in Terraza's design. Tegg sensed this with every fibre of his Mentat training. Did Lucilla know? Tegg did not delude himself that he could pry revelation from a full reverend mother. No, he would have to bide his time, wait and watch and listen. In his own way, this obviously was what Duncan had decided. It was a dangerous course if he thwarted Lucilla. Tegg shook his head.
"Truly, Duncan, I do not know."
"But you follow orders."
"By my oath to the Sisterhood."
"Deceptions, dishonesties, those are empty words when the question is the Sisterhood's survival," Duncan quoted him.
"Yes, I said that," Teg agreed.
"I trust you now because you said it," Duncan said. "But I do not trust Lucilla."
Teg dropped his chin to his breast.
"Dangerous, dangerous."
Much more slowly than once he had done, Teg brought his attention out of such thoughts and went through the mental cleansing process, concentrating on the necessities laid upon him by Terraza.
"You are my Basha."
Duncan studied the Basha for a moment. Fatigue lines were obvious on the old man's face. Duncan was reminded suddenly of Teg's great age, wondering if it ever tempted men such as Teg to seek out the Tleilaxu and become Golas. Probably not. They knew they might become Tleilaxu puppets. This thought flooded Duncan's awareness, holding him immobile so plainly that Teg, lifting his gaze, saw it at once.
"Is something wrong?"
"The Tleilaxu have done something to me. Something that has not yet been exposed," Duncan husked.
"Exactly what we feared."
It was Lucilla speaking from the doorway behind Teg. She advanced to within 2 paces of Duncan.
"I have been listening. You two are very informative."
Teg spoke quickly, hoping to blunt the anger he sensed in her.
"He has mastered the 7 attitudes today."
"He strikes like fire," Lucilla said. "But remember that we of the Sisterhood flow like water and fill in every place."
She glanced down at Teg.
"Do you not see that our Gola has gone beyond the attitudes?"
"No fixed position, no attitude," Duncan said.
Teg looked up sharply at Duncan, who stood with his head erect, his forehead smooth, his eyes clear as he returned Teg's gaze. Duncan had grown surprisingly in the short time since being awakened to his original memories.
"Damn you, Miles," Lucilla muttered.
But Teg kept his attention on Duncan. The youth's entire body seemed wired to a new kind of vigour. There was a poise about him that had not been there before. Duncan shifted his attention to Lucilla.
"You think you will fail in your assignment?"
"Surely not," she said. "You're still a male."
And she thought,
yes, that young body must flow hot with the juices of procreation. Indeed, the hormonal igniters are all intact and susceptible to arousing.
His present stance, though, and the way he looked at her, forced her to raise her awareness to new, energy-demanding levels.
"What have the Tleilaxu done to you?" she demanded.
Duncan spoke with a flippancy that he did not feel.
"Oh, great imprinter, if I knew, I would tell you."
"You think it's a game we play?"
she demanded.
"I do not know what it is we play at."
"By now, many people know we are not on Rakis, where we would have been expected to flee," she said.
"And Gamu swarms with people returned from the scattering,"
Teg said.
"They have the numbers to explore many possibilities here."
"Who would suspect the existence of a lost Noglo from the Harkonnen days?" Duncan asked.
"Anyone who made the association between Rakis and Daris Balad," Teg said.
"If you think this is a game, consider the urgencies of the play," Lucilla said.
She pivoted on 1 foot to concentrate on Teg.
"And you have disobeyed Terraza."
"You are wrong. I have done exactly what she ordered me to do. I am her Bashar, and you forget how well she knows me."
With an abruptness that shocked her to silence, the subtleties of Terraza's manoeuvrings impressed themselves upon Lucilla.
"We are pawns."
What a delicate touch Terraza always demonstrated in the way she moved her pawns about. Lucilla did not feel diminished by the realization that she was a pawn. That was knowledge bred and trained into every reverend mother of the Sisterhood. Even Teg knew it.
"Not diminished, no."
The thing around them had escalated in Lucilla's awareness. She felt awed by Teg's words. How shallow had been her previous view of the forces within which they were enmeshed. It was as though she had seen only the surface of a turbulent river, and from that had glimpsed the currents beneath. Now, however, she felt the flow all around her, and a dismaying realization.
Pawns are expendable.
By your belief in singularities, in granular absolutes, you deny movement, even the movement of evolution. While you cause a granular universe to persist in your awareness, you are blind to movement. When things change, your absolute universe vanishes, no longer accessible to your self-limiting perceptions. The universe has moved beyond you. First draft, Atreides Manifesto, Bene Gesserit Archives. Terrasa put her hands beside her temples, palms flat in front of her ears, and pressed inward. Even her fingers could feel the tiredness in there, right between the hands. Fatigue. A brief flicker of eyelids and she fell into the relaxation trance. Hands against head, with the sole focal points of fleshy awareness. 100 heartbeats. She had practiced this regularly since learning it as a child, one of her first Bene Gesserit skills. Exactly 100 heartbeats. After all of those years of practice, her body could pace them automatically by an unconscious metronome. When she opened her eyes at the count of 100, her head felt better. She hoped she would have at least 2 more hours in which to work before fatigue overcame her once more. Those 100 heartbeats had given her extra years of wakefulness in her lifetime. Tonight, though, thinking of that old trick sent her memories spiraling backward. She found herself caught in her own childhood, the dormitory with the sister Proctor pacing the aisle at night to make sure they all remained properly asleep in their beds. Sister Maram, the Night Proctor. Terrasa had not thought of that name in years. Sister Maram had been short and fat, a failed reverend mother, not for any immediately visible reason, but the medical sisters and their souk doctors had found something. Maram had never been permitted to try the spice agony. She had been quite forthcoming about what she knew of her defect. It had been discovered while she was still in her teens, periodic nerve tremors, which manifested when she began to sink into sleep, a symptom of something deeper that had caused her to be sterilized. The tremors made Maram wakeful in the night. Isle patrol was a logical assignment. Maram had other weaknesses not detected by her superiors. A wakeful child toddling to the washroom could lure Maram into low-voiced conversation. Naive questions elicited mostly naive answers, but sometimes Maram imparted useful knowledge. She had taught Terrasa the relaxation trick. One of the older girls had found Sister Maram dead in the washroom one morning. The Night Proctor's tremors had been the symptom of a fatal defect, a fact important mostly to the breeding mistresses and their endless records. Because the Bene Gesserit did not usually schedule the full solo death education until well into the acolyte stage, Sister Maram was the first dead person Terrasa had seen. Sister Baram's body had been found partly beneath a wash basin, the right cheek pressed to the tile floor, her left hand caught in the plumbing under a sink. She had tried to pull her failing body upright, and death had caught her in the attempt, exposing that last motion like an insect caught in amber. When they rolled Sister Baram over to carry her away, Terrasa saw the red mark where a cheek had been pressed to the floor. The day proctor explained this mark with a scientific practicality. Any experience could be turned into data for these potential reverend mothers to incorporate later into their acolyte conversations with death. Post-mortem lividity. Seated at her chapter house table, all those years removed from the event, Terrasa was forced to use her carefully focused powers of concentration to dispel that memory, leaving her free to deal with the work spread before her. So many lessons. So fearfully full her memory. So many lifetimes stored there. It reaffirmed her sense of being alive to see the work in front of her, things to do. She was needed. Eagerly, Terrasa bent to her labours. Damn the necessity to train the Gola on Gamu. But this Gola required it. Familiarity with dirt underfoot preceded the required restoration of that original persona. It had been wise to send Burzmali into the Gamu arena. If Miles had really found a hideaway, if he were to emerge now, he would need all the help he could get. Once more, she considered whether it was time to play the prescient game. So dangerous. And the Tlelaxu had been alerted that their replacement Gola might be required. Ready him for delivery. Her mind swung to the Rakis problem. That fool Tuek should have been monitored more carefully.
How long could a face dancer safely impersonate him? There was no faulting Audrade's on-scene decision, though. She had put the Tleilaxu into an untenable position. The impersonator could be exposed, plunging the Bene Tleilax into a sink of hatred. The game within the Bene Gesserit design had become very delicate. For generations now, they had held out to the Rakian priesthood the bait of a Bene Gesserit alliance. But now, the Tleilaxu must consider that they had been chosen instead of the priests. Odraid's three-cornered alliance. Let the priests think every reverend mother would take the oath of subservience to the divided god. The priestly council would stutter with excitement at the prospect. The Tleilaxu, of course, saw the chance to monopolize Melange, controlling at last the one source independent of them. A rap at Taraz's door told her the acolyte had arrived with tea. It was a standing order when the Mother Superior worked late. Taraza glanced at the table chrono. An Ixion device so accurate it would gain or lose only 1 second in a century. 1:23:11 a.m. She called to admit the acolyte. The girl, a pale blonde with coldly observant eyes, entered and bent to arrange the contents of her tray beside Taraza. Taraza ignored the girl and stared at the work remaining on the table. So much to do. Work was more important than sleep. But her head ached, and she felt the telltale dazed sensation akin to a stunned brain that told her the tea would provide little relief. She had worked herself into mental starvation, and it would have to be put right before she could even stand. Her shoulders and back throbbed. The acolyte started to leave, but Taraza motioned for her to wait.
"Rub my back, please, sister."
The acolyte's educated hands slowly worked out the constrictions in Taraza's back.
"Good girl."
Taraza smiled at this thought. Of course she was good. No lesser creature could be assigned to the Mother Superior. When the girl had gone, Taraza sat silently in deep thought.
So little time.
She begrudged every minute of sleep. There was no escaping it, though. Eventually the body made its unavoidable demands. She had pressed herself beyond easy recuperation for days now. Ignoring the tea laid out beside her, Taraza arose and went down the hall to her tiny sleeping cell. There she left a call with the night guard for 11 a.m. and composed herself fully robed on the hard cot. Quietly, she regulated her breathing, insulated her senses from distraction, and fell into the between state. Sleep did not come. She went through her full repertoire, and still sleep evaded her. Taraza lay there for a long time, recognizing at last the futility of willing herself to sleep with any of the techniques at her disposal. The between state would have to do its slow mending first. Meanwhile, her mind continued to churn. The Rakian priesthood she had never considered to be a central problem. Already caught up in religion, the priests could be manipulated by religion. They saw the Bene Gesserit chiefly as a power that could enforce their dogma. Let them continue to think this. It was bait that would blind them.
Damn that Miles Teg.
3 months of silence, and no favourable report from Burzmali either. Charred ground, signs of a no-ship's liftoff.
Where could Teg have gone?
The Gola might be dead. Teg had never before done such a thing. Old reliability, that was why she had chosen him, that and his military skills and his likeness to the old Duke Leto, all of the things they had prepared in him. Teg and Lucilla, a perfect team. If not dead, was the Gola beyond their reach? Did the Tleilaxu have him? Attackers from the scattering? Many things were possible. Old reliability. Silent. Was his silence a message? If so, what was he trying to say? With both Shuang Yu and Patrin dead, there was the smell of conspiracy around the Gamu events. Could Teg be someone planted long ago by the Sisterhood's enemies?
Impossible.
His own family was proof against such doubts. Teg's daughter at the family home was as mystified as anyone.
3 months now, and not a word.
Caution. She had warned Teg to exercise the utmost caution in protecting the Gola. Teg had seen the great danger on Gamu. Shuang Yu's last reports made that clear. Where could Teg and Lucilla have taken the Gola? Where had they acquired a no-ship? Conspiracy? Taraz's mind kept circling around her deep suspicions. Was it O'Drade's doing? Then who conspired with O'Drade? Lucilla? O'Drade and Lucilla had never met before that brief encounter on Gamu. Or had they? Who bent close to O'Drade and breathed a mutual air weighted with whispers? O'Drade gave no sign, but what proof was that? Lucilla's loyalty had never been doubted. They both functioned perfectly as assigned, but so would conspirators. Facts. Taraza hungered for facts. The bed rustled beneath her and her sense insulation collapsed, shattered by worries as much as by the sound of her own movements. Resignedly, Taraza once more composed herself for relaxation. Relaxation, and then sleep. Ships from the scattering flitted through Taraza's fatigue-fogged imagination. Lost ones returned in their uncounted no-ships. Was that where Teg found a ship? This possibility was being explored as quietly as they could on Gamu and elsewhere. She tried counting imaginary ships, but they refused to proceed in the orderly fashion required for sleep induction. Taraza came alert without moving on her cot. Her deepest mind was trying to reveal something. Fatigue had blocked that path of communication, but now she sat up, fully awake. That Leilaxu had been dealing with people returned from the scattering. With these whorish, honored matres, and with returned Benet Leilax as well. Taraza sensed a single design behind events. The Lost Ones did not return out of simple curiosity about their roots. The gregarious desire to reunite all of humankind was not enough in itself to bring them back. The honored matres clearly came with dreams of conquest. But what if the Tleilaxu sent out in the scattering had not carried with them the secret of the axolotl tanks? What then? Melange. The orange-eyed whores obviously used an inadequate substitute. The people of the scattering might not have solved the mystery of the Tleilaxu tanks. They would know about axolotl tanks and try to recreate them, but if they failed... Melange. She began to explore this projection. The Lost Ones ran out of the true melange their ancestors took into the scattering. What sources did they have then? The worms of Rakis and the original Benet Leilax. The whores would not dare reveal their true interest. Their ancestors believed that the worms could not be transplanted. Was it possible the Lost Ones had found a suitable planet for the worms? Of course it was possible. They might begin bargaining with the Tleilaxu as a diversion. Rakis would be their real target. Or the reverse could be true. Transportable wealth. She had seen Teg's reports on the wealth being accumulated on Gamu. Some among the ones returning had coinages and other negotiable chips. That much was plain from the banking activities. What greater currency was there, though, than the spice? Wealth. That was it, of course. And whatever the chips, the bargaining had begun. Taraza grew aware of voices outside her door. The acolyte sleep guard was arguing with someone. The voices were low, but Taraza heard enough to bring her into full alert. "She left a wake-up for late morning," the sleep guard protested. Someone else whispered, "She said she was to be told the moment I returned." "I tell you, she is very tired. She needs to be obeyed. Tell her I'm back." Taraza sat up and swung her legs over the edge of the cot. Her feet found the floor. Gods, how her knees ached. It pained her, too, that she could not place the intruding whisper, the person arguing with the guard. "Whose return did I?" "Basmali." "I'm awake," Taraza called. Her door opened and the sleep guard leaned in. "Mother Superior, Basmali has returned from Gamu. Send him in at once." Taraza activated a single glow globe at the head of her cot. Its yellow light washed away the room's darkness. Basmali entered and closed the door behind him. Without being told, he touched the sound insulation switch on the door, and all outside noises vanished. Privacy? It was bad news, then. She looked up at Basmali. He was a short, slender fellow, with a sharply triangular face narrowing to a thin chin. Blonde hair swept over a high forehead. His widely spaced green eyes were alert and watchful. He looked far too young for the responsibilities of a Basha, but then Teg had looked even younger at Arbalo. "We are getting old, damn it." She forced herself to relax and place her trust in the fact that Teg had trained this man and expressed full confidence in him.
"Tell me the bad news,"
Terraza said. Buzmali cleared his throat.
"Still no sign of the Bashar and his party on Gamu, Mother Superior."
He had a heavy, masculine voice. And that's not the worst of it, Terraza thought. She saw the clear signs of Buzmali's nervousness.
"Let's have it all," she ordered. "Obviously you have completed your examination of the keep's ruins."
"No survivors," he said. "The attackers were thorough."
"Tlelaxu?"
"Possible."
"You have doubts?"
"The attackers used that new Ixian explosive, 12 Yuri. I think it may have been used to mislead us. There were mechanical brain probe holes in Shuang Yu's skull, too."
"What of Patrin?"
"Exactly as Shuang Yu reported. He blew himself up in that decoy ship. They identified him from bits of two fingers and one intact eye. There was nothing left big enough to probe."
"But you have doubts. Get to them."
"Shuang Yu left a message that only we might read."
"In the wear marks on furniture?"
"Yes, Mother Superior. And..."
"Then she knew she would be attacked and had time to leave a message. I saw your earlier report on the devastation of the attack."
"It was quick and totally overpowering. The attackers did not try to take captives."
"What did she say?"
"Whores."
Terraza tried to contain her shock, although she had been expecting that word. The effort to remain calm almost drained her energies. This was very bad. Terraza permitted herself a deep sigh. Shuang Yu's opposition had persisted to the end, but then, seeing disaster, she had made a proper decision. Knowing she would die without the opportunity to transfer her memory lives to another reverend mother, she had acted from the most basic loyalty. If you can do nothing else, arm your sisters and frustrate the enemy.
So the honored Matres have acted. "Tell me about your search for the Gola," Terraza ordered.
"We were not the first searchers over that ground, Mother Superior. There was much additional burning of trees and rocks and underbrush."
"But it was a no-ship?"
"The marks of a no-ship."
Terraza nodded to herself. A silent message from old reliability?
"How closely did you examine the area?"
"I flew over it, but on a routine trip from one place to another."
Terraza motioned Buzmali to a chair near the foot of her cot.
"Sit down and relax. I want you to do some guessing for me."
Buzmali lowered himself carefully onto the chair.
"Guessing?"
"You were his favorite student. I want you to imagine that you are Miles Teg. You know you must get the Gola out of the keep. You do not place your full trust in anyone around you, not even in Lucilla. What will you do?"
"An unexpected thing, of course."
"Of course."
Buzmali rubbed his narrow chin. Presently he said,
"I trust Patrin. I trust him fully."
"All right, you and Patrin. What do you do?"
"Patrin is a native of Gamu."
"I have been wondering about that myself," she said.
Buzmali looked at the floor in front of him.
"Patrin and I will make an emergency plan long before it is needed. I always prepare secondary ways of dealing with problems."
"Very good. Now, the plan. What do you do?"
"Why did Patrin kill himself?"
Buzmali asked.
"You're sure that's what he did?"
"You saw the reports. Shuang Yu and several others were sure of it. I accept it. Patrin was loyal enough to do that for his Basha."
"For you. You are Miles Teg now. What plan have you and Patrin concocted?"
"I would not deliberately send Patrin to certain death."
"Unless?"
"Patrin did that on his own. He might if the plan originated with him and not with... me. He might do it to protect me, to make sure no one discovered the plan."
"How could Patrin summon a no-ship without our learning of it?"
"Patrin was a Gamu native. His family goes back to the Giri Prime days."
Terraza closed her eyes and turned her head away from Buzmali. So Buzmali followed the same suggestive tracks that she had been probing in her mind.
"We knew Patrin's origins.
What was the significance of this Gamu association?" Her mind refused to speculate. This was what came of allowing herself to become too tired. She looked once more at Buzmali.
"Did Patrin find a way to make secret contact with family and old friends?"
"We've explored every contact we could find."
"Depend on it. You haven't traced them all."
Buzmali shrugged.
"Of course not. I have not acted on that assumption."
Terraza took a deep breath.
"Go back to Gamu. Take with you as much help as our security can spare. Tell Belonda those are my orders. You must insinuate agents into every walk of life. Find out who Patrin knew. What of his surviving family, friends? Winkle them out.
That will cause a stir, no matter how careful we are. Others will know.
That cannot be helped. And Bosmali?
He was on his feet.
Yes, Mother Superior?
The other searchers. You must stay ahead of them.
May I use a guild navigator?
No.
Then how?
Bosmali, what if Miles and Lucilla and Argola are still on Gamu?
I've already told you that I do not accept the idea of their leaving in a no-ship.
For a long silent period, Terraza studied the man standing at the foot of her cot, trained by Miles Tagg, the old Basha's favourite student. What was Bosmali's trained instinct suggesting? In a low voice she prompted,
Yes?
Gamu was Gidi Prime, a Harkonnen place.
What does that suggest to you?
They were rich, Mother Superior. Very rich.
So?
Rich enough to accomplish the secret installation of a no-room, even of a large no-globe.
There are no records. Ix has never even vaguely suggested such a thing. They have not probed on Gamu for
bribes. Third-party purchases. Many transshipments, Bosmali said. The famine times were very disruptive. And before that, there were all those millennia of the tyrant,
when the Harkonnens kept their heads down or lost them. Still, I will admit the possibility.
Records could have been lost, Bosmali said.
Not by us or the other governments that survived. What prompts this line of speculation?
Patrin.
Ah.
He spoke quickly.
If such a thing were discovered, a Gamu native might know about it.
How many of them would know? Do you think they could have kept such a secret for... Yes, I see what you mean. If it were a secret of Patrin's family...
I have not dared question any of them about it.
Of course not. But where would you look without alerting?
That place on the mountain, where the no-ship marks were left.
It would require you to go there in person.
Very hard to conceal from spies, he agreed. Unless I went with a very small force, and seemingly on another purpose.
What other purpose?
To place a funeral marker in memory of my old Basha.
Suggesting that we know he is dead? Yes.
You've already asked the Thrilaxu to replace Argola?
That was a simple precaution and does not bear on... Bosmali, this is extremely dangerous. I doubt we can mislead the kinds of people who will observe you on Gamu.
The mourning of myself and the people I take with me will be dramatic and believable.
The believable does not necessarily convince a wary observer.
Do you not trust my loyalty and the loyalty of the people I will take with me?
Terraza pursed her lips in thought. She reminded herself that fixed loyalty was a thing they had learned to improve upon from the Atreides pattern. How to produce people who command the utmost devotion. Bosmali and Tegg both were fine examples.
It might work, Terraza agreed.
She stared speculatively at Bosmali. Tegg's favourite student could be right.
Then I'll go, Bosmali said.
He turned to leave.
One moment, Terraza said.
Bosmali turned.
You will saturate yourselves with Shear, all of you, and if you're captured by face dancers, these new ones, you must burn your own heads or shatter them completely. Take the necessary precautions.
The suddenly sober expression on Bosmali's face reassured Terraza. He had been proud of himself for a moment there. Better to dampen his pride. No need for him to be reckless.
We have long known that the objects of our palpable sense experiences can be influenced by choice, both conscious choice and unconscious. This is a demonstrated fact that does not require that we believe some force within us reaches out and touches the universe. I address a pragmatic relationship between belief and what we identify as real. All of our judgments carry a heavy burden of ancestral beliefs to which we of the Bene Gesserit tend to be more susceptible than most. It is not enough that we are aware of this and guard against it. Alternative interpretations must always receive our attention.
Mother Superior Terraza, Argument in Council.
God will judge us here!
Waff gloated. He had been doing that at unpredictable moments all during this long ride across the desert. Shiana appeared not to notice, but Waff's voice and comments had begun to wear on Odraid. The Rakian sun had moved far down to the west, but the worm that carried them appeared untiring in its drive across the ancient Saria toward the remnant mounds of the tyrant's barrier wall.
Why this direction? Odraid wondered.
No answer satisfied. The fanaticism and renewed danger from Waf, though, demanded immediate response. She called up the cant of the Shariat that she knew drove him.
Let God do the judging and not men.
Waf scowled at the taunting note in her voice. He looked at the horizon ahead and then up at the thopters, which kept pace with them.
Men must do God's work, he muttered.
Odraid did not answer. Waf had been deflected into his doubts and now would be asking himself, did these Bene Gesserit witches really share the great belief? Her thoughts dove back into the unanswered questions, tumbling through all she knew about the worms of Rakis. Personal memories and other memories wove a mad montage. She could visualize robed Fremen atop a worm even larger than this one, each rider leaning back against a long hooked pole that dug into a worm's rings as her hands now gripped this one. She felt the wind against her cheeks, the robe whipping against her shanks. This ride and others merged into a long familiarity.
It has been a long time since an Atreides rode this way.
Was there a clue to their destination back in Dar es Balat? How could there be? But it had been so hot, and her mind had been questing forward to what might happen on this venture into the desert. She had not been as alert as she might have been. In common with every other community on Rakis, Dar es Balat pulled inward from its edges during the heat of the early afternoon. Odraid recalled the chafing of her new stillsuit while she waited in a building's shadows near the western limits of Dar es Balat. She waited for the separate escorts to bring Shiana and Waf from the safe houses where Odraid had installed them. What a tempting target she had made. But they had to be certain of Rakian compliance. The Bene Gesserit escorts delayed deliberately.
Shaitan likes the heat, Shiana had said.
Rakians hid from the heat, but the worms came out then. Was that a significant fact, revealing the reason for this worm to take them in a particular direction?
My mind is bouncing around like a child's ball.
What did it signify that Rakians hid from the sun, while a little Tlelaxu, a reverend mother, and a wild young girl went coursing across the desert atop a worm? It was an ancient pattern on Rakis. Nothing surprising about it at all. The ancient Fremen had been mostly nocturnal, though their modern descendants depended more on shade to protect them from the hottest sunlight. How safe the priests felt behind their guardian moats. Every resident of a Rakian urban center knew the Kanat was out there, water running slick in shadowed darkness, trickles diverted to feed the narrow canals whose evaporation was recaptured in the wind traps.
Our prayers protect us, they said, but they knew very well what really protected them. His holy presence is seen in the desert.
The holy worm, the divided god. Odraid looked down at the worm rings in front of her.
And here he is.
She thought of the priests among the watchers in the thopters overhead, how they loved to spy on others. She had felt them watching her back in Dar es Balat while she awaited the arrival of Shiana and Waf. Eyes behind the high grills of hidden balconies, eyes peering through slits in thick walls, eyes concealed behind mirror plies or staring out from shadowed places. Odraid had forced herself to ignore the dangers while she marked the passage of time by the movement of the shadow line on a wall above her. A shore clock in this land where few kept other than sun time. Tensions had built, amplified by the need to appear unconcerned. Would they attack? Would they dare, knowing that she had taken her own precautions? How angry were the priests at being forced to join the Tlelaxu in this secret triumvirate? Her reverend mother advisers from the keep had not liked this dangerous baiting of the priests.
Let one of us be the bait.
Odraid had been adamant.
They would not believe it. Suspicions would keep them away. Besides, they are sure to send Albertus.
So Odraid had waited in the Dar es Balat courtyard, green-shadowed in the depths where she stood looking upward at the sunline 6 stories overhead, past lacy balustrades at each balconied level, green plants, brilliant red, orange and blue flowers, a rectangle of silvery sky above the tiers, and the hidden eyes. Motion at the wide street door to her right. A single figure in priestly gold, purple and white let himself into the courtyard. She studied him, looking for signs that the Thaylaxu might have extended their sway by another face dancer mimic. But this was a man, a priest she recognized. Albertus, the senior of Dar es Balad.
Just as we expected.
Albertus moved through the wide atrium and across the courtyard toward her, walking with careful dignity. Were there dangerous portents in him? Would he signal his assassins? She glanced upward at the tiered balconies, little flickering motions at the higher levels. The approaching priest was not alone.
But neither am I.
Albertus came to a stop, 2 paces from Odrade, and looked up at her from where he had kept his attention on the intricate gold and purple designs of the courtyard's tiled floor.
He has weak bones, Odrade thought.
She gave no sign of recognition. Albertus was one of those who knew that his high priest had been replaced by a face dancer mimic. Albertus cleared his throat and took a trembling breath.
Weak bones, weak flesh.
While the thought amused Odrade, it did not reduce her wariness. Reverend mothers always noted that sort of thing. You looked for the marks of the breeding. Such selectivity as existed in the ancestry of Albertus carried flaws, elementals that the sisterhood would try to correct in his descendants if it ever appeared worthwhile to breed him. This would be considered, of course. Albertus had risen to a position of power, doing it quietly but definitely, and it must be determined whether that implied valuable genetic material. Albertus had been poorly educated, though. A first-year acolyte could have handled him. Conditioning among the Rakian priesthood had degenerated badly since the old fish-speaker days.
"Why are you here?" Odrade demanded,
making it as much an accusation as a question. Albertus trembled.
"I bring a message from your people, Reverend Mother." "Then say it." "There has been a slight delay, something about the route here being known by too many."
That, at least, was the story they had agreed to tell the priests. But the other things on the face of Albertus were easy to read. Secrets shared with him were dangerously close to exposure.
"I almost wish I had ordered you killed," Odrade said.
Albertus recoiled 2 full paces. His eyes went vacant, as though he had died right there in front of her. She recognized the reaction. Albertus had entered that fully revelatory phase where fear gripped his scrotum. He knew that this terrible Reverend Mother Odrade might pass a death sentence upon him quite casually, or kill him with her own hands. Nothing he said or did would escape her awful scrutiny.
"You have been considering whether to kill me and destroy our keep at Keen," Odrade accused.
Albertus trembled violently.
"Why do you say such things, Reverend Mother?"
There was a revealing whine in his voice.
"Don't try to deny it," she said. "I wonder how many have found you as easy to read as I do. You are supposed to be a keeper of secrets. You are not supposed to be walking around with all of our secrets written on your face."
Albertus fell to his knees. She thought he would grovel.
"But your own people sent me." "And you were only too happy to come and decide whether it might be possible to kill me. Why would we—" "Silence! You do not like it that we control Shiana. You are fearful of the Tleilaxu. Matters have been taken from your priestly hands, and things have been set in motion that terrify you." "Reverend Mother, what are we to do? What are we to do?" "You will obey us. More than that, you will obey Shiana. You fear what we venture this day? You have greater things to fear."
She shook her head in mock dismay, knowing the effect all of this was having on poor Albertus. He cringed beneath the weight of her anger.
"On your feet," she ordered, "and remember that you are a priest, and the truth is demanded of you."
Albertus stumbled to his feet and kept his head bowed. She could see his body responding to the decision that he abandoned subterfuge. What a trial that must be for him. Dutiful to the Reverend Mother, who so obviously read his heart, now he must be dutiful to his religion. He must confront the ultimate paradox of all religions.
"God knows." "You hide nothing from me, nothing from Shiana, and nothing from God," Odrade said. "Forgive me, Reverend Mother." "Forgive you?
It is not in my power to forgive you, nor should you ask it of me. You are a priest.
He lifted his gaze to Odraid's angry face. The paradox was upon him completely now. God was surely here. But God was usually a long way away, and confrontations could be put off. Tomorrow was another day of life. Surely it was, and it was acceptable if you permitted yourself a few small sins, perhaps a lie or two, for the time being only. And maybe a big sin if temptations were great. Gods were supposed to be more understanding of great sinners. There would be time to make amends. Odraid stared at Albertus with the analyzing eye of Missionaria Protectiva.
Ah, Albertus, she thought, but now you stand in the presence of a fellow human who knows all of the things you believed were secrets between you and your God.
For Albertus, his present situation could be little different from death, and that ultimate submission to the final judgment of his God. That surely described the unconscious setting for the way Albertus let his willpower crumble now. All of his religious fears had been called up and were focused on a reverend mother. In her driest tones, not even compelling him with voice, Odraid said,
I want this farce ended immediately.
Albertus tried to swallow. He knew he could not lie. He might know a remote capability of lying, but that was useless. Submissively, he looked up at Odraid's forehead, where the line of her still-suit cap had been drawn tightly across her brow. He spoke in little more than a whisper.
Reverend Mother, it is only that we feel deprived. You and the Tlilaxu go into the desert with our Shiana. Both of you will learn from her and...
His shoulders sagged.
Why do you take the Tlilaxu?
Shiana wishes it, Odraid lied. Albertus opened his mouth and closed it without speaking. She could see acceptance flood through him.
You will return to your fellows with my warning, Odraid said. The survival of Rakis and of your priesthood depend utterly on how well you obey me. You will not hinder us in the slightest, and as to these puerile plots against us, Shiana reveals to us your every evil thought.
Albertus surprised her then. He shook his head and emitted a dry chuckle. Odraid already had noted that many of these priests enjoyed discomfiture, but had not suspected that they might find amusement in their own failures.
I find your laughter shallow, she said.
Albertus shrugged and restored some of his facial mask. Odraid had seen several such masks on him.
Facades.
He wore them in layers. And far down under all of that defensiveness lay the someone who cared, the one she had exposed here so briefly. These priests had a dangerous way of falling into florid explanations, though, when taxed too heavily with questions.
I must restore the one who cares, Odraid thought.
She cut him off as he started to speak.
No more! You will wait upon me when I return from the desert, for now you are my messenger. Carry my message accurately, and you will win a greater reward than you have ever imagined. Fail, and you will suffer the agonies of Shaitan.
Odraid watched Albertus scurry out of the courtyard, shoulders hunched, his head thrust forward as though he could not get his mouth within speaking distance of his peers soon enough. On the whole, she thought, it had gone well. A calculated risk and very dangerous to her personally. She was sure there had been assassins on the balconies above her waiting for a signal from Albertus. And now, the fear he carried back with him was a thing the Bene Gesserit understood intimately through millennia of manipulations. As contagiously virulent as any plague. The teaching sisters called it a directed hysteria. It had been directed, aimed was more accurate, at the heart of the Rakian priesthood. It could be relied upon, especially with the reinforcement that now would be set in motion. The priests would submit. Only the few immune heretics were to be feared now.
This is the awe-inspiring universe of magic. There are no atoms, only waves and motions all around. Here you discard all belief in barriers to understanding. You put aside understanding itself. This universe cannot be seen, cannot be heard, cannot be detected in any way by fixed perceptions. It is the ultimate void where no preordained screens occur upon which forms may be projected. You have only one awareness here, the screen of the Magi, imagination. Here you learn what it is to be human. You are a creator of order, of beautiful shapes and systems, an organizer of chaos.
The Atreides Manifesto, Bene Gesserit Archives.
What you are doing is too dangerous, Teg said. My orders are to protect you and strengthen you. I cannot permit this to continue.
Teg and Duncan stood in the long, wood-panelled hallway just outside the No-Globe's practice floor. It was late afternoon by the clock of their arbitrary routine, and Lucilla had just swept away in anger after a vituperative confrontation. Every meeting between Duncan and Lucilla lately had taken on the nature of a battle. Just now she had stood in the doorway to the practice hall, a solid figure saved from being stolid by her softening curves, the seductive movements obvious to both males.
"Stop it, Lucilla," Duncan had ordered.
Only her voice betrayed her anger.
"How long do you think I will wait to carry out my orders?"
"Until you or someone else tells me that I..."
"Terrazza requires things of you that none of us here knows," Lucilla said.
Teg tried to soothe the mounting angers.
"Please, isn't it enough that Duncan continues to improve his performance? In a few days I will start keeping regular watch outside. We can..."
"You can stop interfering with me, damn you," Lucilla snapped.
She whirled and stalked away. As he saw the hard resolution on Duncan's face now, something furious began to work in Teg. He felt impelled by the necessities of their isolated situation. His intellect, that marvellously honed Mentat instrument, was shielded here from the mental uproar to which it adjusted on the outside. He thought that if he could only silence his mind, bring everything to stillness, all things would become clear to him.
"Why are you holding your breath, Basha?"
Duncan's voice impaled Teg. It required a supreme act of will to resume normal breathing. He felt the emotions of his two companions in the No-Globe as an ebb and flow temporarily removed from other forces. Other forces. Mentat awareness could be an idiot in the presence of other forces that swept through the universe. There might exist in the universe people whose lives were infused with powers he could not imagine. Before such forces, he would be chaff, moved on the froth of wind currents. Who could plunge into such an uproar and emerge intact?
"What can Lucilla possibly do if I continue to resist her?" Duncan asked.
"Has she used voice on you?"
Teg asked. His own voice sounded remote to him.
"Once."
"You resisted?"
Remote surprise lurked somewhere within Teg.
"I learned the way of that from Paul Muad'Dib himself."
"She is capable of paralyzing you, and..."
"I think her orders prohibit violence."
"What is violence, Duncan?"
"I'm going to the showers, Basha."